You probably don't give much thought to jellyfish unless you've been stung by one, but according to Lisa Ann Gershwin, the director of the Australian Marine Stinger Advisory Services, jellyfish populations are on the rise and on the move, so much so that they threaten to crash the world's fisheries, outcompete tuna and swordfish, starve the whales to extinction, and are already displacing penguins in Antarctica. She addresses the impending jellification of the oceans in her new book called Stung on Jellyfish Blooms and the Future of the Ocean. It's published by University of Chicago Press in this country. And I'm very pleased to welcome Lisa Ann Gershwin to our show today. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you? You're in Australia. That must mean you're in the middle of the night.
It's about 3 in the morning here. And I should say g'day, actually. So I'm down here in Hobart in Tasmania, kind of in the very bottom of Australia, not all that far from Antarctica.
Now, let's start with the basics. What's a jellyfish bloom?
A bloom is just a term we use for sort of a swarm. So it's kind of like a spring bloom of flowers where, you know, one day you look out and you see just a meadow of kind of grasses, and the next day you look out and there's this fabulous bloom of flowers that seems to have come out of nowhere. And jellyfish work the same way where, you know, you don't see much out there, and then all of a sudden, boom, you just see tons and tons of them. So we use the term bloom to mean that same sort of phenomenon.
They've been in existence for about 550 million years. Have their populations remained relatively constant over all that time?
Well, that's really hard to say. I mean, certainly some probably have and others, God only knows. But, you know, we're actually, I mean, part of the problem is they don't fossilize very well. So there are some jellyfish fossils, but we don't really know very much. But what we do know is that in recent decades, they've become very much more populous in many places that are quite disturbed around the world. And we're actually seeing these blooms occurring in alarming numbers in many places.
Are we blaming climate change on this change?
In part, but it's more than just climate change. It's a mix of overfishing, pollution, urban sprawl, you know, warming waters. It's just so many things. And each area that's got these jellyfish bloom problems has kind of a unique mix of different types of disturbances that are leading, we believe, to increased jellyfish numbers. So it kind of looks like the commonality is disturbance itself, not necessarily one type of disturbance, but just disturbance, and to enough of an extent that the jellyfish are actually benefiting from, you know, ecosystems that have some sort of change to it that they're able to exploit.
And another factor you say in your book is acidification of our oceans. Do jellyfish thrive in rough situations like that, in bad conditions?
They do.
Are they able to better
do.
Adapt to conditions that other marine life might find uninhabitable?
That's exactly right. You hit it right on the nose, where in some cases, you know, such as warming waters, jellyfish actually respond really well to that directly. But in many cases, such as pollution or ocean acidification, jellyfish respond indirectly simply by having fewer predators and competitors around. So many types of more sophisticated animals, such as fish and whales and sharks and, well, sharks are fish, but anyway, you know what I mean. So more sophisticated animals than jellyfish, they find it very difficult to survive changed conditions, whereas jellyfish are kind of the last man standing. They don't mind changed conditions. It doesn't bother them at all.
And they fill the vacuum. But they need oxygen to survive as well, although you write that some jellyfish have evolved to absorb oxygen into their bells to achieve the equivalent of scuba diving so that they can fish for prey in deeper waters. Does that mean that jellyfish aren't affected when ocean waters become deoxygenated in those dead zones?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So jellyfish do need oxygen, but they need so little that they can actually survive very low oxygen environments with no problem at all, whereas, you know, fish and other types of animals, crustaceans, whatever, simply can't survive it. But jellyfish can also be in anoxic areas, that is, areas without oxygen, because they are able to store the oxygen in their bodies, in their actual gelatinous tissue, and then they can sort of access it as they need it, like scuba divers. And so it's really amazing how many of these coastal areas throughout the world are suffering from what we call eutrophication, or too much nutrients. You know, it comes in sewage outfalls or fertilizers coming down in the rivers, whatever. But these coastal regions are many, many places around the world. We're seeing these dead zones of hypoxia and anoxia, or low oxygen or no oxygen. And in these areas, these hypoxic and anoxic areas, we're seeing very, very large numbers of jellyfish. So again, where other organisms die, jellyfish are kind of the last man standing.
I'm talking with Lisa Ann Gershwin, director of the Australian Marine Stinger Advisory Services and author of Stung on Jellyfish Blooms and the Future of the Ocean. There are lots of different kinds of jellyfish, aren't there? There's one type that's been nicknamed the zombie jelly because it's virtually immortal. Does that mean it never dies?
That is the most amazing jellyfish, Turritopsis. What a trip. Yeah, it is immortal, and it was discovered in Italy, and the fact of it being immortal was discovered in Italy, and it's absolutely fascinating. What happens is when the jellyfish actually dies and it starts to disintegrate, just like anything does when it dies, instead of actually continuing the disintegration process, the cells actually re-aggregate and form into an alternate life form. Jellyfish have this very strange life cycle that's not like anything that we know. They have a polyp stage that's like a little tiny sea anemone or a little coral polyp, and the jellyfish is only half of the life cycle. The polyp is the other half. And so when the jellyfish has babies, they don't grow up to look like jellyfish. They grow up to look like these little polyps. And then the polyps can clone lots of replicates of themselves, and they can also bud off baby jellyfish. So this Turritopsis, this zombie jellyfish, is absolutely bizarre because it actually reforms as polyps when it dies instead of just disintegrating and becoming mush. And so it is truly biologically immortal. It's the first thing we know of in the natural world that is actually truly biologically immortal.
Then in the area where you live, off of Australia and Tasmania, are the box jellyfish. They're huge, aren't they? And their sting leaves you with about 4 to 6 minutes to live?
Or less, yeah. They are unbelievably toxic. So the box jellyfish, Chironex fleckeri, is about the size of a man's head, and it's got four clusters of tentacles, one on each corner of its box-shaped body. And each of these clusters of tentacles carries 15 tentacles that are each about, 10 to 15 feet long, something like that. And, about 6 to 10 feet long. Sorry, I'm trying to translate.
So they're
huge. Oh, never mind. Yeah, and so they've got an enormous amount of sting power, and they are so highly toxic that a sting from these guys, if you get enough sting, and that's only really about 2 to 3 tentacles that you need worth of sting, you die in an average of 4 minutes. Many people die in as little as 2 minutes, but the average time to death is 4 minutes.
And no serum?
They say that if you live 10... Yeah, they say that if you live 10 minutes, you're going to survive it. So it all happens very, very quickly.
And there's no serum to protect us against this poison? Or against the... go ahead.
No, that's what's interesting. There is an antivenom, but it can't be administered quickly enough because it has to be administered by a doctor or an ambulance officer or somebody like that. And they can't actually get to the patients quickly enough to administer the antivenom before the patient dies. And so we've got many, many cases where the antivenom has been administered and the patients have survived, but we think they would have survived anyway. Whereas we really don't have any cases where we believe the patient would have died if not for the antivenom.
Now, why did they need this venom?
It's a very interesting... We have no idea why they need it. They are unbelievably highly toxic, far more than they need for defense or catching food. We have no idea why they're so toxic.
And then there are other stories that you tell. In November 2009, a net of jellyfish was heavy enough to capsize a Japanese trawler. The largest jelly in the net weighed more than 450 pounds. There was an incident in July 27, 2006, that led to headlines that read, "Jellyfish take on U.S. warship."
Indeed. There are some amazing things that jellyfish have been getting up to, behaving very, very badly. And, you know, that was part of the pleasure of writing the book, was being able to bring some of these stories together and, you know, basically just say, hey, you know, look at this. This is unbelievable. And, you know, these jellyfish in Japan that are, you know, that have capsized that trawler that I talk about, these jellyfish are unbelievably huge. They're the size of sumo wrestlers or the size of refrigerators. And they're drifting into the Sea of Japan, into the fishing grounds, at a rate of 500 million a day. A half a billion a day drifting into the fishing grounds in Japan from the seas in China where they're breeding. And it's staggering, the numbers and the size of these things. And it's staggering the amount of problems they're causing.
And then you write that the Black Sea has been particularly affected by jellyfish, where the growing population of I'm not going to pronounce this right, Nemeopsis jelly managed to cripple three national economies and wiped out an entire ecosystem.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Nemeopsis is the most diaphanous, most mucousy nothingness of jellyfish that you can imagine. If you pick one up in your hands, it's so mucousy and squishy. It's like phlegm. It just falls right through your fingers. And it's the size of a fist. And yet, this unbelievably nothing of a jellyfish wiped out three economies. It's unbelievable. It got introduced in ballast water that helps stabilize ships. It got introduced in ballast water into the Black Sea accidentally, and within just a few years of being introduced, it had taken over and become about 95% of the biomass in the Black Sea. So it had wiped out everything. And the
That's
way
sturgeon,
that
right?
do this...
Sorry? Sturgeon that produce caviar are in the Black Sea?
Absolutely. And sturgeon and all kinds of things. And
anchovies.
These economies rely on fishing. And not only the economies rely on fishing, but people rely on fishing for food on their own tables. But what happened there, and it's the same thing we see all over the world that jellyfish are doing, is they eat the eggs and larvae of fish, and they eat the plankton that the larvae would eat. So this double whammy of predation and competition wipes out the food chain. It just cripples the food chain at the knees. And it's an unbelievably simple but unbelievably effective way of really taking over. And then fish can't come back, because once the jellyfish have hold of these ecosystems, any fish that are born just get eaten.
Lisa, I have to end it.
It's pretty amazing.
Lisa Ann Gershwin, she has lots of horror stories about their impact on nuclear power plants, the ones with tooth-like structures. In her book called Stung, on Jellyfish Blooms and the Future of the Ocean, from the University of Chicago Press. Thank you so much for talking with us.